absolutely thrilled to have today an old friend, Kajal Vyas of the Wall Street Journal, to talk to us about a topic that we have in some ways avoided coming back to, but knew we had to. But recent developments have made it imperative to come back to the topic, and this is the topic of Venezuelan bonds. Now, there's just so much to talk about with regards to Venezuelan bonds. In an upcoming episode, we will talk about recent developments in the New York courts with respect to the validity of PDVSA bonds and what's going to happen there. But today, drawing from one of Kajal's pieces just about a week or so ago, we want to talk about the U.S. strategy of barring trading in Venezuelan bonds as a way to hurt the Maduro government, and then them backtracking and removing those bars on trading. And I'm hoping Kajal can give us a little bit of a flavor of what happened. This was a bar that was put in place during the Trump administration, and it seemed dumbass then and continued to be dumb. And yet the Biden administration, even though now it's trying to take credit, they didn't exactly move fast in removing this bar, even though I am pretty sure it was quite clear that it was, let's just use the technical term again, dumbass right from the start. But we also have bars on trading of Russian bonds and trading of Belarus bonds, and there are no North Korean sovereign bonds. So this is sort of a widespread strategy. And so, Kajal, can you first welcome to our podcast? Thank you so much for joining us. But can you give us sort of the overview story, and then Mark and I can get into the details?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, just to answer your question, I guess the Trump administration, you know, they put a blanket ban on trading Venezuelan debt back. They started moving in on this in 2018, and there was further sanctions leveled again in 2019. But this was really part of their so-called maximum pressure campaign, which was geared at cutting off any financing channels or any avenues to move money that the Maduro government had in Venezuela. And it was part of also their, you know, political decision in the U.S. that, you know, Maduro was a illegitimate government and you know, needed to be isolated until they stepped down from power. Now, at the most superficial level, I guess you could say that the wide-ranging sanctions that the U.S. applied on Venezuela, you know, didn't meet their desired goals. And just by the very fact that Maduro is still there, these sanctions were designed to really, you know, topple his government, and really they were pretty blunt about that. And so I think I mean, I try to avoid calling him a failure or not, but I think at that level, yeah, I think you can say they definitely did fail to meet that specific goal. Now, you know, I'm sure your audience knows, you know, they might be thinking, you know, banning secondary market debt trading, like how does that, you know, cut off money to the regime? Because in theory, these bonds are already issued, and, you know, this is just, you know, investors placing bets on these securities. Now, there are some precedents actually where Venezuela had, you know, stashed away bonds, sovereign bonds that they had issued in private placements, and they were holding in central bank accounts. There was a very famous case back in 2018 where another story that actually we, not to toot my own horn, but we did break that as well back then. But Goldman Sachs had made a very large purchase of about $2.8 billion in Venezuelan bonds that were held by the central bank. They bought them at, like, you know, 30 cents on the dollar, 31 cents at the dollar, something like that. So it was a huge discount And this drew a huge political backlash at that time. And so given that whole kind of political context, geopolitical context at that time, we had the Trump administration level these very rigid bans. Now fast forward to the Biden administration, we knew already that very senior advisors to President Biden were very sour on sanctions. They saw them as counterproductive, and they kind of already telegraphed their intention to roll back many of these punitive measures that they felt were either not working or at the end of the day really actually counterproductive to U.S. Foreign policy interests. And so there was at simultaneously a very strong lobbying effort by U.S. Financial institutions that still held a very significant number of Venezuelan bonds, who did not want to sell when the sanctions were leveled, as many did. There was about $50 billion of Venezuelan bonds that were held by U.S. financial institutions back when the Trump administration leveled the sanctions, and about half of those were sold off because investors, obviously didn't want to hold on to something that may eventually be worthless. And so, but there was a group that held on to it, and they made a very strong case to U.S. Policymakers with what they would claim is strong evidence that because Americans were cut out from this market, that other U.S. adversaries were stepping in to buy these Venezuelan bonds with the hopes of gaining leverage over the government of Caracas. And so they provided a pretty a number of transaction records showing a number of family off-run offices, investment houses in the Middle East, in Qatar specifically, and the United Arab Emirates, as well as Cyprus, that had been gobbling up some Venezuela billions of dollars in Venezuelan debt that were, on the black market because of sanctions. And these investment houses were also buyers of Russian debt after similar sanctions were leveled against the trading of Russian debt. And so it really helped fortify an argument internally, as we've learned, showing policymakers that this was, not a wise policy, and we saw a rollback of it. It also kind of, I mean, I guess what drew our attention to the issue was also that in October, the U.S. relieved a whole, relaxed a whole host of sanctions against Venezuela as part of a rapprochement effort, if you will. They've been trying to, cut deals and try to make inroads, improve relations effectively. With the hopes that Venezuela will return to becoming a democracy. I think that's still debatable whether that's going to happen, but they basically, the US lifted sanctions on three main areas, on the oil sector, the gold sector, and this bond trading ban that they had leveled, secondary bond trading ban. And so they lifted all three. They said the oil and the gold could be leveled, could be reapplied at any time, but they put no deadline on the bond sanctions, which tells us that they clearly considered them in a different category and had a numerous different other considerations behind them.
So can we talk about those other considerations? Because the timing is interesting in the sense that the other sanctions that were lifted, things have kind of gone sideways, at least insofar as I can tell. The rapprochement has not had not gained the momentum I think that they were hoping. And so maybe in April, who knows what's going to happen with the other sanctions that were lifted. But the ban on bond trading seems to have been viewed as such a widespread and kind of clear failure that even in this sort of mixed environment where the rapprochement's not going so well, it seems like that sanction is going to be gone for good. But I want to talk, I hope you can talk a little bit about what the objectives are, you think, for the Biden administration in lifting them. I mean, in a sense, the the migration of bonds into the hands of non-US parties, including US parties in subject to the control of foreign adversaries. Like, you didn't have to be a genius to predict that that was going to happen back, back when the sanctions were first levied. So it was a terrible idea maybe to impose the sanctions at the outset, but that doesn't necessarily make it a good idea to lift them. So what is the hope that will happen once the sanctions are lifted?
Oh yeah, well I think so we also learned about a diplomatic cable that was sent up from the US State Department with some of their recommendations. And one of their policy recommendations to the executive branch of the US government was to lift this specific bond trading ban, because they thought that down the road, whenever the day comes of a restructuring, that if the sanctions remain in place, the U.S. effectively is shooting itself in the foot. They're not going to have a seat at the table. They're going to lose clout, in having a role in whatever a Venezuelan debt restructuring looks like. So that was a big, at least we've been told by U.S. policymakers on the record as well as off the record, that this was a major consideration for them, and that they've been very cagey acknowledging exactly what intelligence they reviewed. But broadly, they say they acknowledge that the sanctions policy as it stood left openings for US adversaries to increase their leverage, increase their strategic foothold, and so they want to cut off that chain. The other thing also, Mark, I'm not sure if this answers your question, but I mean, I guess this was one of their considerations also, was that they also recognized that Maduro was not using this market to finance himself at the moment. Yeah, I don't believe there's any more outstanding bonds that they have stashed in Venezuelan institutions that they could use to raise cash on the sly. And there was also just one other kind of footnote. Something else that the Trump administration had really considered was that they viewed the paying of bonds also as a potential vehicle for corruption, because Venezuela for a while was selectively defaulting. They were paying some bonds, but they were not foregoing payments on others. And so, regime insiders with advanced knowledge of which ones are going to be paid and which ones are not could obviously benefit from this. And so, these were considerations at the time when the US was hammering Caracas with everything they had. And clearly the Biden administration saw them as not very wise moves that they think that may have actually set them back.
I mean, I don't know if I'm being too cynical here, but I can see that the result of lifting the sanctions is going to enrich some U.S. parties, and I'm kind of indifferent to that. That's perfectly fine by me. But is it could the Biden administration have been sold a bill of goods here? Like it sounds like the kind of implicit claim is that the bonds are going to migrate away from the bad guys and into the hands of US parties. And that seems kind of implausible to me. Like, if there are investors out there who are acting in cahoots with the Russian government, for instance, which wants to acquire strategic assets in Venezuela, like, why are those bonds aren't going to migrate back into the hands of US parties? And given the legal structure of the debt stock, it's easy to buy blocking positions so you can't be crammed down in a bondholder vote and so forth. So I just like, am I being too cynical here by thinking that this is just a story that US investors have concocted to explain why it's in the US government's interest to make them richer?
Mark, you're hitting at the million-dollar question there, because that's definitely something that we strongly considered. We've also been—I guess one of the things that really jumped out at me in our reporting process was, we learned from people who were very closely involved with this that they never actually saw what they considered smoking gun evidence, that the Russians were actually buying these bonds. They had strong suspicions. But as far as we know, no, undeniable evidence. So I think when you take that into consideration, plus the fact that Russia is a very, let's say, common boogeyman that's used in lobbying circles. We've heard from numerous people on Capitol Hill who told us about, they were not only familiar with, the bondholders' lobbying efforts and, raising the specter of Russian meddling. But that similar arguments had been used also by people in the oil industry. They say the exact same thing. The US is banning oil companies from participating in Venezuela, which happens to sit on the world's largest oil reserves. That's going to allow, Russians and Chinese and Iranians to, get all the contracts. And so this was something that was heard a lot. And I, in our story, we did make reference to, one of the architects of the Trump era policy, former senior Treasury official, who, was pretty blunt with me. At least he said, he thought that a lot of these arguments were just fear mongering, that these were, people who stood to benefit from the relief, the relaxing of those sanctions, and we're going to use these arguments to do whatever was obviously to their benefit. And so that's still to be determined, Mark. I guess this is a long answer, a long-winded way of saying that we don't know for sure, but I think you're asking a very, very important question.
So, Kajal, this is fascinating because I am also not persuaded that the arguments for why we need to remove the ban will help us geopolitically. I mean, the ban was stupid in terms of achieving the goals that it supposedly was aimed at in the first place, because Trump administration didn't have good evidence. And now in hindsight, we know that the Maduro government was not using their stash of bonds to raise capital. And then there was the whole drama over the so-called hunger bonds that
Right.
your superb reporting revealed. But there weren't a lot of other sort of Goldmans grabbing up these stashes of bonds. But this ban on bond trading had this popularity, and they banned the secondary market trading of Venezuelan bonds, thinking this was going to hurt the Maduro government. And one of the parts of the story that we haven't touched upon yet was the idea that, while you couldn't trade, you could sue. And that there would be that there's some somehow these sanctions would elicit support on the part of bondholders, whether they liked it or not, in terms of forcing a lot of litigation against Venezuela, and then the seizing of assets and the chasing of assets all over the world. And the same theory was also put forward by the Biden folks when they did the ban on secondary market trading of Russian assets. Again, at least the chatter that I heard in the back rooms was, oh, we'll induce lots of litigation against Russia. Like, none of this has really happened. I mean, there's been lots of wasteful litigation, but I'm like it just seems like a massive massive bout of idiocy from both administrations. And now they're not saying we were all wrong. They're trying to concoct this new bullshit story to persuade us that they're doing something new. I mean, what's going to happen with the ban on secondary market trading on Russian bonds? They're going to let that lapse, that th those sanctions? Or it's just sort of once you do a stupid thing, you can't reverse it unless you have some boogeyman to tell the new story.
Yeah, well, I think, Mithu, I think you're getting at something which also came up a lot in our reporting, which I remember somebody that I spoke with on Capitol Hill, on the Republican side actually, who was quite critical of the sanctions, policy and how it was implemented. I mean, they didn't think it was wrong to sanction Nicolas Maduro's government for, all the human rights abuses, et cetera. But they thought, the way it was carried out was probably not the not the wisest strategy. But I remember this former aide to the Senate telling me that that it's just you can't really expect logic to triumph over politics. And so a lot I think what this person was trying to emphasize is that sometimes these sanctions are leveled perhaps not as thought out as we would hope, and maybe for short term, political posturing. It's a tough one. And you're absolutely right. I mean, we don't have clarity on, okay, if they found this ban to be counterproductive in the Venezuelan context, we did ask Treasury for clarity on their positions, on these other countries where secondary bond trading is also barred, but we did not get an answer over what policy implications this would have out away outside of Venezuela.
So, Kajal, can I just follow up? I don't want to miss asking you about this because it seems very important. So, in your article, and I apologize if I missed a follow-up article, but in your article that caused us to reach out to you and ask if we could please get you on the podcast, you predicted that Venezuelan bonds would be put back into the index. And that seems to have happened. Your prediction was right. And that a bunch of holders who were holding Venezuelan bonds got very rich, or got even richer. And as I assume, they knew that their lobbying efforts were going to come to fruition. But I'm interested in that part of the equation. So I remember, and Mark will too, that there was a lot of lobbying, some of it from human rights organizations and the like, to take Venezuelan bonds out of the index. People thought, let's put pressure on JP Morgan, and a lot of pressure was put on them to remove Venezuelan bonds from the index. Now, we can't really blame the US government for that part. At least I don't think so. Maybe they played a role in twisting JP Morgan's arm there too. And I remember that the folks on at JP Morgan were reluctant because they have certain rules about certain rules that they hoped were predictable on when you get into the index and when you're not in the index. But they eventually caved and they took them out of the index. Can you tell us about that part of the story, about how they decided to put them back in the index, and broader implications here about the index? Because the index is a very key determinant of whether or not institutional investors are going to hold this stuff, right?
Absolutely. No, I think that's a great point. Now, as much as I would love to give credit to our crystal ball here, it wasn't that much of a prediction in that sense, in the sense that JP Morgan had already said that that Venezuelan bonds were on a special watch list for potentially being reincorporated into this benchmark, their MB EMBI indices. And so we didn't note that, and what I kind of surprised to see things as fast as they did, but we did actually just get a notice from JP Morgan just late last week saying that they eventually did make the decision to reincorporate Venezuelan bonds onto the index. That's a process that's going to take about 3 months, since I think it starts in late April. But nonetheless, yeah, you hit it right on the head, Mitu. I mean, this is a big win for those who firms that held on to the bonds, especially the participants of this lobbying effort as well. They already got a fairly sizable boost after the lifting of the sanctions, and then obviously this helps because it kind of brings Venezuelan bonds back into the legitimate financial world, if you will. I mean, they're now an asset that's in this important index, and institutional investors will have to well, presumably will want to hold them if they're measuring up against this benchmark. No, there was a very strong lobbying effort years ago, as you mentioned. This was part of the whole political effort to isolate the Venezuelan government as much as possible. I have actually heard from some of those people who were involved in that lobbying effort back then, and they do actually flag. They did actually have a kind of minor gripe with the way we framed our story, in the sense that they weren't completely sold that the debt sanctions were completely off the table. And I think this kind of goes back also to what I was saying earlier, which is that maybe political considerations may triumph, and the U.S. may not have any other tools to show that it's being tough on Venezuela than doing something like this. However, the fact that they've gone under this long revision process at JP Morgan, have decided to get Venezuela back into the index, I think is a sign that they have some confidence as well that these sanctions will not be reapplied in the near term.
And just can I interject for just a second? So that a lot, some of the earlier reporting, although not, I think, yours, was also linking this decision of whether to include Venezuelan bonds back in the index to the risk that sanctions not directly related to bonds would be reimposed. So the oil sanctions that, in principle, run through April. So is that also true, do you think, of those kind of tangentially related sanctions, that this is a sign that folks are predicting that those are also not going to be reimposed?
Yes, no, absolutely. I mean, there's been you have to kind of really dissect a lot of the wording from that we've gotten from the U.S. From the White House, basically, which has been leading the talks with the Maduro government. Now, I mean, it's really kind of a you have to be a bit of a Venezuelan political junkie, unfortunately, which most people aren't. But the sanctions relief that the U.S. has granted Venezuela in recent months is intricately tied to the local political dynamic. So there's supposed to be elections later this year. Chances of them being, what you and I would consider a fair election are fairly slim, given how things are panning out. But the U.S. wants progress on this, very major development in the country, for a number of reasons. I mean, not just because of the sanctions, policy, but also, they want the country to somewhat get back to a relative stability, just because it's bleeding so many migrants into the rest of the world. I mean, it's turned into actually the biggest migration crisis in the Americas. It's about nearly 8 million Venezuelans out of the country, so they want some economic stability restored, and so the U.S. The Biden advisors have been very clear in terms of that they don't want to go back to the Trump era maximum pressure policy. But at the same time, the Venezuelans are not playing ball, and so they need to show that they're being tough. And so they're slowly reapplying some things. I mean, they reapplied the gold sector sanctions by mid-April. We're expecting some version of oil sector sanctions to be returned. After that, it's just a big black hole, Mark. We don't know what the policy future is. It may get to a point where, determined to hold a rigged election, or maybe not even hold an election. We don't know. And what does the U.S. do then? It's a great question. There will be pressure to, show that they're taking some punitive actions. And obviously the other risk is what happens within the US with the elections later this year, because if there's a change in government, you could see the policy framework might be going right back to zero and starting all over again. And who knows where to.
Yeah, and if what happens in Venezuela is a black hole, can I ask you to kind of speculate about a deeper, darker, blacker hole, which is So it's hard not, as the trading in bonds revives, it's hard not to start wondering again about when sanctions are lifted enough for a meaningful debt restructuring to become a possibility. I don't, do we know anything? I mean, I totally take your point that things are kind of crazy politically here in the United States, and policy continuity is not a thing that we've been doing super well these days. But I do we have a sense of like when that's going to become feasible yet?
I don't. I'm sorry to say. And what also doesn't help is that there's so many disparate actors. You have the bondholders. You also have there's various companies like ConocoPhillips, the oil company that they have arbitration awards. They are there's various different actors looking for pieces of the pie, and trying to get the limited number of Venezuelan assets in the world. And so it is a huge mess, to put it, I guess, lightly. And I don't have clarity, Mark, on when something like that could even be feasibly, worked on. I mean, in theory, the US still considers the Venezuelan government as illegitimate. I think there has to be some change in the US position on that, which I think is also a big limiting factor, in terms of even thinking about, negotiating a restructuring.
Kajal, thank you so much. This has been one of the most fun episodes for me because I've learned so much from you that we've done, and I it's clear that we're going to have to do multiple other episodes with you. But just to close, I'm going to throw something out. You don't have to answer. I think you answered really the restructuring question from Mark beautifully, and there's just so much uncertainty there. But if I had a lot of money and a lot of lobbyists, I would be, let's say, contributing heavily to both political parties, and extracting promises as to what they're going to do with respect to a future restructuring. I think, as Mark alluded to earlier in the podcast, the reality of all of this Venezuelan debt and maybe a lot of the arbitration claims, and I mean, it's so much of it is US based. It's governed by US law. The contracts are governed by US law. Assets are in the US. Venezuela, if it ever comes back to economic activity with the broader world, will have a huge amount of its activity going through the US again. And so the US government is going to play a key role in getting Venezuela back on its feet. And if people with money can extract promises from both folks in the future Trump administration or future Biden administration, as to what they're going to do, that is going to determine stuff. And right now, both political parties have their hands out for political contributions. All right. So here's my last question, and then we'll close, and you can just say, I don't really know. But do you see indications that people are sort of putting their ducks in a row for what's going to happen with the next administration, sort of extracting promises that, look, we won't do anything boneheaded again?
I have to be honest, I don't know, but I've definitely heard a lot of speculation over what a Trump 2.0 administration would look like. Just because, I mean, obviously, I've been covering Venezuela for too long, it was quite unusual, rare for, I guess, folks down here to see a government take up the cause of Venezuelan pro-democracy activists. I mean, Trump, talked about it all the time. He had, activists, he invited them to the Oval Office. So, I mean, it was a, if you believe the rhetoric, I mean, they definitely put Venezuela on the map and they seem to care, at least from the local
Yeah,
perspective.
although he loves Putin and he loves autocrats and he doesn't love democracy. So that the whole thing is sort of, I mean, I can see him turning on a dime.
You're getting to exactly the point I was getting to, which is I've heard people say that he may see Maduro as a winner. He likes winners. So he definitely had he definitely had a kind of a, let's say, friendly interactions with Kim Jong-un, and so there's definitely examples of that. So, it's possible we might see a very different approach under a different government.
Thank you so much.